NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. This was a week when all the platitudes faded, all sense of limits, too, and the post-Senate acquittal president came out swinging at diplomats and national security aides and prosecutors and just about anyone else critical of him. It was a week of the long knives. Attorney General William Barr intervened to soften the prison sentence of a longtime Trump advisor. But even he took to ABC News to tell his boss to pipe down.
To have public statements and tweets made about the department, about our people in the department, our men and women here, about cases pending in the department, and about judges before whom we have cases, make it impossible for me to do my job.
Connecticut Senator Richard Blumenthal, a Democrat, warned of the potential abuse of power.
Every American is potentially in danger of this kind of retribution and revenge if the president uses the justice system as a tool of political or personal vengeance.
This hour on Point, raw power and retribution in Washington and the pursuit of power by the president's Democratic rivals. Joining me first to take stock of what has happened in the nation's capital this week, Susan Glasser of The New Yorker magazine, where she writes the weekly column, Letter from Trump's Washington. Susan, welcome to On Point.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Quite a column you dropped earlier this morning. Let's talk a little bit about this in the grand sweep. We've mentioned the Attorney General's actions. We're going to get to that. We can talk about it. We'll talk about it a bit more later this hour. But there were a lot of things to fold in when we think about how the president has acted in just the past week alone. People ushered out of government, people condemned, people questioned in terms of their loyalty to the president himself. How would you characterize what you've witnessed?
Well, it's definitely not subtle, is it? One senator called it the president's personal retribution tour. And what's striking is that it's continued on. It's, of course, an aspect we're already familiar with of the Trump era, that so much happens, it's hard to remember what it was like 8 days ago. But it's worth noting that the president is not getting over impeachment, but in fact seems increasingly and still very much fixated on vengeance, on rooting out what he perceives to be disloyalty inside of the administration, and really focused on retribution at the expense of moving forward and even potentially at the expense of his own political benefit, you would think.
In what way?
Well, Republicans, like Democrats, understand you have to win an election by presenting a worldview to something. President Trump, because he so often conflates himself with the national interest or with the interests of his administration, that's a pretty hard thing to campaign on for people.
The president's allies on Fox News and other conservative pundits, some of the more stridently pro-Trump figures in the Republican Senate, have effectively cheered on some of what the president has done. Give us a little flavor for those for whom some of these events were a little dizzying over the course of the past week. Give us a flavor of what actually happened and why it matters.
Well, you're right about the cheering on and the alternate media universes, and I think that does explain a lot of why we're seeing this. In Trump's world and the reinforcing world of the TV that he looks at and the radio he looks at, he's a noble anti-corruption crusader who is doing battle with the evil forces of the deep state who've conspired against him since the beginning of his presidency. It's complicated and elaborate, and I'm struck by how often they will even bring up things that you and I have probably never even heard of. But the president, remember, he had his national prayer breakfast rant, and then he had his victory celebration, which featured many Republican members of Congress who had helped to defend him during impeachment. And from there, what he has done is he's essentially gone after witnesses in the impeachment saga, or even people who figured in it in very, very minor roles. And for example, there was a woman at the Pentagon who wrote emails trying to figure out what to do about the $400 million in aid that Trump had demanded be withheld from Ukraine, even though legally she was not clear that there was any real basis for doing so. She's now been denied a promotion. Alexander Vindman, the lieutenant colonel at the National Security Council, who listened in on the call with Ukraine's president and was troubled by it, he was frog marched out of the White House along with his twin brother, who, by the way, was not a witness in the impeachment. So, you know, this
But I think showed up in the hearing, right? Like showed up behind him to support his brother, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, he showed up in the hearing to support his brother. And also, he also worked on the National Security Council as a lawyer. And Vindman and his brother, I understand, were at the initial meeting with the National Security Council lawyers in which Vindman expressed concerns about what he'd heard on the phone call.
I only mentioned the fact that the brother was there in part because sometimes it seems to me as though some of this anger or retribution is because things become public rather than that they've occurred. That is, this woman at the Pentagon, you know, up for a job there, it was because her emails were released publicly. I don't know that there's no sense that there's retribution taken against her because of the objection per se. It feels as though it's because we know about it and because the public is aware that somebody internally had a different idea than what the president wanted to have happen.
Absolutely. I think that's a very important point. Optics reign supreme in this White House, in many White Houses, but in particular for Donald Trump, who sees himself not only as a creature of the media, but a master manipulator of it. That came out in impeachment itself. Remember when it was Gordon Sondland, who also was ousted as part of this purge.
Ambassador to the EU.
Absolutely. And he said that, in fact, Trump cared about announcing the investigations by the Ukrainians even more than what happened in the investigation. So the optics reign supreme. And, you know, to me, that is a big lesson here as well, that Trump remains focused on the perception of his power because he believes that projecting strength is a form of strength itself. And, you know, what I wrote about in my column this week was that really echoed with me in my experience in the former Soviet Union with sort of aspiring authoritarians. They are looking to do things that at times seem over the top to us. You know, the retribution tour and the vengeance that Trump has been wreaked, it's hard to see that in any other context, frankly, than he wants to communicate in an over the top way. Do not cross me.
There was a line that jumped out at me from your column, quoting, I guess, a former Soviet official, or maybe it was – I guess it was a Russian official by that point. And you wrote that he said to you, power lies in making people accept the unacceptable.
Well, that's right. I just been thinking very much about this election I went to in the Azerbaijan, the former Soviet country of Azerbaijan in 2003. And the old dictator was ailing and died a couple of months later and was seeking to install his son in power, not popular, seen as a playboy, not qualified for the job. There was a real dissident movement at this point in time, an actual opposition party, thousands of people in the streets. Not only did the son win an election that Western observers said was rigged and not free and fair, but over the top with 80% of the vote. And I said to this Russian the day afterwards, who'd also been there, you know, why if they're going to steal the election, why be so insulting to people's intelligence as to, you know, steal it? Nobody believes that he won 80%. And the Russian said to me, that's the point. You're missing the point. The point is not to have 55%. It's to have 80%. It's for people to be forced to accept the implausible that really shows your power and strength.
You know, nobody's saying that the president's going to do that any moment soon for Don Jr. There are folks who say you know, it's Trump being Trump. Republican allies will say, look, love him, hate him. We kind of love the guy. But, you know, you got to let him blow off steam. The attorney general, I think it was. No, I mean, it might not have been the attorney general. But forgive me, some of the president's allies, Lou Dobbs among them, a very different figure than the attorney general, nonetheless, said, think of all that the president has gone through. Doesn't he deserve to be able to express himself? Doesn't he deserve to be able to run the government that he heads? You know, on Wednesday, the president hailed Attorney General Bill Barr for pulling back the Justice Department's call for a tough prison sentence for convicted Trump advisor Roger Stone. Then the president ranted against the career federal prosecutors involved in making the original sentencing recommendation.
Somebody said he put out a tweet, and the tweet, you based it on that. We have killers, we have murderers all over the place, nothing happens. And then they put a man in jail and destroy his life, his family, his wife, his children. 9 years in jail, it's a disgrace. In the meantime, Comey walks around making book deals, the people that launched the scam investigation, and what they did is a disgrace.
The president was making his remarks beside Ecuadorian President Lenin Moreno. So you're hearing Moreno's interpreter talking in the background there. Comey did have one book deal, not multiple book deals, whatever the specifics there. In the couple minutes we have left, Susan Glasser, what makes this different than a rant? What makes this week different than what came before the president went through the impeachment process?
Well, I think that's a good point, actually, to show that it's not just tweets, it's not just ranting, but it's actions. And that, I think, is why you're hearing the heightened level of alarm, this concern that the president is essentially threatening the independence of the Justice Department and saying that there should be a different standard of justice, putting his hand on the scale for Roger Stone, who not only is Trump's oldest political advisor, but directly seemed to have been the link between WikiLeaks and the hacked Democratic emails and giving that early intelligence to the Trump campaign through the president himself in 2016. So a very significant figure. So this is not just about ranting and raving. It's about the perception that justice is different, as being rigged on behalf of a key Trump advisor. And so I think that's why you're hearing this heightened level of concern. It also explains, we haven't talked about it, but Attorney General Bill Barr's extraordinary interview yesterday, in which he appeared to criticize the president for publicly intervening in this case in a way that compromised Barr's ability to do his job. And yet Barr himself is such a compromised figure that there are, you know, many Democrats and critics of the president who do not take him at face value.
We're hearing there from Susan Glasser, offering us not only canonical concerns about the president's actions, but some canine ones as well. Susan Glasser, a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine, author of the weekly column Letter from Trump's Washington. She's also co-author of the forthcoming book, The Man Who Ran Washington, The Life and Times of James A. Baker III. Thanks so much for your time today, Susan.
Thank you, David.
When we return, we'll pick up more about the attorney general's actions, dive more deeply into the week that just played out, and later on, we'll talk about the Democratic eyes on the prize. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. A bit later on, we'll look at what happened this week in the Democratic race for the presidential nomination and a bit more. Right now, let's burrow more deeply into this week's news from Washington. And from Washington, we're joined by Molly Ball. She's national political correspondent for Time Magazine. Welcome back, Molly.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
And we also have Gerald Seib. He's executive Washington editor for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for taking the time to join us today, Jerry.
Happy to be with you.
So let's start with that that what Bill Barr did this week and what Bill Barr had to say this week. And let's start with that interview that's been making news. Yesterday, the Attorney General, William Barr, gave an interview to ABC News' Pierre Thomas in which he pushed back against the president, saying presidential tweet storms and other criticism were making his job impossible.
I am responsible for everything that happens in the department, but the thing I have most responsibility for are the issues that are brought to me for decision. And I will make those decisions based on what I think is the right thing to do, and I'm not going to be bullied or influenced by anybody. And I said at the time, whether it's Congress, newspaper, editorial boards, or the president, I'm going to do what I think is right. And I think I cannot do my job here at the department with a constant background commentary that undercuts me.
So Jerry Seib, a rare rebuke from the president, from both one of his closest allies and also from a cabinet secretary, right? And at the same time, there's a context to these remarks. And the context is what played out here with Roger Stone. Walk us through that, the days and the sequence of what happened at the first part of this week that led to that interview.
Yeah, well, I was just going to say, there's a lot of context here.
But, right.
So you had a remarkable sequence of events. You had The Justice Department making a sentencing recommendation in the trial of Roger Stone, a presidential friend who's been convicted and who's awaiting sentencing. And it was a recommendation for a harsh sentence up to 9 years. The president tweets, that's ridiculous. It's unfair. It's a miscarriage of justice. The prosecutors have gotten carried away. And then the Justice Department the next day pulls back the sentencing recommendation, offers a new version that says, well, the judge should just decide what the sentence should be. And that original recommendation was too harsh, seeming to respond to the president's tweet. And then four prosecutors who were working on the case resign the case. One of them resigns the Justice Department entirely. And then basically abuse begins to rain down on Bill Barr because he seems to have allowed the Justice Department to be turned into a tool of the president's wishes and an agency that isn't independent but that responds to the president's desires to help his friends and hurt his enemies. Then Bill Barr decides to make a statement in an ABC interview that is directly designed to directly refute that and to say directly to the president, stop it. Stop telling us what to do. You're making my life impossible. And I think what Bill Barr is trying to do there are three things. First of all, he's trying to protect his own integrity. Second of all, he is trying to send a signal to the president to stop making my life impossible. But third, he's likely also trying to prevent a mass mutiny at the Justice Department from prosecutors who didn't sign up to be pushed around by the president, who take seriously the idea that they have their own integrity and their own independence, and that justice is supposed to be blind. So I think all those things were going on in one piece there.
And Jerry, like, let's just take a moment to just do a little acknowledgement here. Roger Stone, a dirty trickster for President Nixon back in the day, longtime Trump advisor, an operative of the 2016 campaign. As Susan Glasser mentioned a few minutes ago on the show, he had been, in a sense, a conduit, it appears, according to prosecutors, to WikiLeaks certain kinds of communication about what kinds of leaks of information from Democratic emails would help them during the 2016 campaign. Not contrite. You know, didn't plead guilty as some folks who have been prosecuted in related things have, and who, at least by in the account of prosecutors, essentially seemed to menace the judge in some of his online postings, which right. might help characterize what happened there. So this is an unusual case, and they felt overruled not just by Central Justice, which with whom they conferred, but by the Attorney General himself.
Right. And it was a case in which Roger Stone committed the ultimate sin in the eyes of many prosecutors, which is to seem to flaunt the prosecution and the judge and almost mock them and says, I'm not taking the idea that I should be remorseful seriously at all. I think there are two footnotes here worth noting, which are also remarkable. One is that the president didn't just go after the prosecutors. He went after the judge in this case via Twitter and after a juror, which is really remarkable. And that's – I don't think we've ever seen anything quite like that before. And then secondly, I think that more broadly, I think we are at kind of an inflection point for the Republican Party here in which they have to decide whether the party is going to try to move on beyond impeachment, as most senators seem to want to do, or whether they're going to just wallow in retaliation, which seems to be what the president wants to do. And so that is also a broader context in which this is all playing out.
Molly Ball, I want to bring in a question from a listener, which is about these very developments, and see what your thoughts were on that. Mel is a lifelong independent. She called from the Front Range in Utah to share with us her thoughts on Bill Barr in response to his interview where he said Trump is making it impossible to do his job.
The AG's statement doesn't sound sincere or consistent with any of his behavior in the past. He says that it makes his job impossible to do, and yet the president had not a single negative thing to say about Barr criticizing him publicly. That's absolutely inconsistent with the behavior and statements of both of those two people.
I got to tell you, Molly, it did strike me that Barr has been not only, you know, a supporter of the president, but has been an incredible ally for him as the president exerts sort of this notion of almost unbridled executive authority and power, right? How do you reconcile the Barr's rebuke this week with Barr's notion of the president's what limits there are or aren't on the president and his strong support for the president in the past?
Yeah, well, I think that the most generous reading of Barr's actions is in the sort of dichotomy between the two things that you just laid out. Barr does not see himself as a mere henchman of Donald Trump, as a Roy Cohn, as an enforcer for him, as the president's personal lawyer. Rather, he has a very detailed and congruent theory of executive power. It's rather exotic by the standards of most legal experts, but he does see this in a philosophical point of view. He gave that famous Federalist Society speech that was deplored by many critics, but where he laid out this theory of the case that the president does have these nearly unbridled executive powers. So that is more about the office than about the man. And we see that the way Trump sees it is very much about himself personally. And so but I think it, as the listener said, you know, it's clear that this was a calculated move by Bill Barr. It's been reported that he discussed it with the president beforehand. So this was very much about sending a public signal. And because of Barr's actions to defend the president to date, including arguably, you know, misrepresenting the Mueller report and many other things, have decreased his credibility in a lot of quarters and made it harder for him to be seen as a man of integrity when he does make this kind of public pushback. And I think a cynic would also note that although he did make this very unambiguous public statement against the president, he didn't actually do anything about what the president has been doing. He didn't, you know, rescind that recommendation or undo it to try to, you know, get the prosecutors reinstated who resigned in protest. He merely made a statement, and many of his critics have said, well, this was just about trying to mollify the rank and file of the Justice Department. He doesn't actually intend to do anything to rein in the president. And we see, in fact, the president still doing exactly what Bill Barr told him not to do, tweeting about the case this morning.
I just saw a tweet from earlier today, Donald J. Trump, Real Donald Trump account. It says, quote, "The president has never asked me to do anything in a criminal case, A.G. Barr." That is the president quoting Bill Barr. Then he says, "This doesn't mean that I do not have, as president, the legal right to do so. I do, but I have so far chosen not to." The president saying he has the authority to intervene in the case, as Barr appropriated for himself, which he does, it seems, have the right to do. But nonetheless, appropriated himself the right to have discretion in the Stone case. Usually in such politically charged cases, my understanding is they tend to be left to the political staff. Molly, I also want to ask you, this seems to be a week in which we saw a lot of people brought closed in who are seen as loyalists, and a lot of people purged by the president, as Susan Glasser earlier alluded to, who are seen as insufficiently loyal. So this week we saw announcements that Hope Hicks would be returning from a brief 2-year sojourn with the Murdochs over at Fox Corporation. She'd been a longtime assistant to the president, being brought back in. A guy named John McEntee, I think that's how we pronounce the name, who's going to lead the White House Office of Personnel. Molly, remind us who he was and remind us why he might be a controversial choice to run that office.
Well, as you say, you know, he's a longtime loyalist, and the president's obsession with loyalty borders on paranoia. He has always been, since the day he took office, he's been obsessed with and he's not wrong to perceive that there were a lot of people, there have been a lot of people in the administration who were not necessarily his biggest fans. We see this in the deluge of leaks on a daily basis, the constant usually anonymous criticism from within the administration of the president's own actions. So, you know, he still looks around and sees himself surrounded by people who may not have his best interests at heart. But I think the trend has been that as he becomes increasingly unfettered, as he survives things like impeachment, he increasingly feels that he has free rein to get rid of those people he finds suspicious, whether that's warranted or not, and to surround himself by people with whom he has a great deal of comfort. And these two are definitely in that category.
McEntee trusted, although he had been fired by the president's former chief of staff over during an investigation into allegations of financial crimes. In addition, there were these other actions taken. Jesse Liu, Jerry Seib, was nominated for a Treasury Secretary undersecretary position. In addition, we had a number of folks forced out. Elaine McCusker was going to be nominated to be the Pentagon's comptroller. She was done. There were the Vindman brothers were shuffled out the door. Is this a normal sequence of events in a White House where there are controversies, or is there any other way to look at this, Jerry Seib, as a question of the president's perceiving vindication and taking vengeance?
Well, you also have to add to the list Maria Yovanovitch, who was the ambassador to Ukraine, who resigned formally from the State Department this week because I don't think she really had a job left over there. Look, I mean, I think the president has made it very clear in both actions and words that he wants to settle scores after impeachment. And as I said earlier, I think that this brings him to a point of departure with other Republicans who would like to take a deep breath, having declared victory by acquitting the president in the Senate trial and impeachment, and move on and try to show that they can still govern, they're interested in governing. And that's not where the president is, president's head is at. I would note that there's, you know, this is not being met with universal cheers with among all of his normal fans. I mean, our own editorial page at the Wall Street Journal, and I have nothing to do with the editorial
right.
page.
You
I come from the news
separate.
Side. We're very separate, so I don't know
right.
what they do. They don't know what I do. But I noted with interest there is an editorial in our on our editorial page, a conservative editorial page that's you know been helpful to the president in other contexts. That is headlined Trump's own worst enemy, and it is referring to Trump himself. And the final paragraph reads, he is helping the Democrats who are running against the senators who voted to acquit, and he is making millions of voters ask if they really want to take a risk on giving him so much power for another 4 years. And I think you see in those words a desire among some Trump friends and allies and conservatives and Republicans to move on and to talk about the economy, to talk about where the country is going, to be normal. And the president doesn't seem to want to do that. And that's a point of friction. Where it goes, I don't know. But it's interesting. It's an interesting point for the Republicans to arrive at.
Molly Ball, there's the mention of Yovanovitch at a speech at Georgetown. She really sort of came out against the leadership of the nation when it comes to diplomatic affairs abroad, the Secretary of State, although not by name, and the leaders in the administration on this. And John Kelly, the former chief of staff for the president, he came out saying that that Vindman did his job by calling things as he saw them, by testifying under oath to what he believed took place and what he believed happened, and really saying that the Ukraine initiative was inappropriate, deeply inappropriate. How important are those statements by John Kelly in this context?
You know, it's actually been surprising to me to date how few former administration officials have spoken out against the president, given the mm-hmm. uneasy relationships that so many of them have had, given how many of them have been fired, in many cases not in a dignified manner.
Humiliated,
exactly. Fired by tweet or fired in some other undignified way. And so and yet we have seen a lot of forbearance today. You know, General Mattis being very restrained in his criticisms in his book. There have been a couple of tell-alls, but really not the sort of deluge given what a massive exodus there have been from this administration. So I think, you know, we're starting to see that we're seeing it. You know, we saw the fruits, I guess, of the president's difficult relationship with his own executive branch in the course of the House impeachment proceedings, when so many of these career officials who'd been sort of ordered not to speak, nonetheless came forward and testified and felt that it was more important for whatever reason to tell the truth as they saw it than to obey the president. And we see now more and more of these former administration officials willing to speak out. And I think what it is it's very simple and very earnest. They feel a sense of alarm. They look at what the president is doing and they see a man who, at least in their view, is out of control. And so they feel compelled to speak. I think it is absolutely the case that if the president were doing what, you know, as Jerry alluded to, what the Republicans in the Senate would like, which is sort of pretend impeachment never happened, move on, pretend to be at least a little bit chastened, I don't think we would see quite this same flood of outspokenness.
You know, and David, I would just add that
one
of the ironies here is that this happens just as it was. There were many signs that the impeachment process actually helped the president in his bid for reelection. He exited impeachment in better shape than he entered it, which is maybe surprising to some, but maybe also suggests Democrats overreached.
Helped
in any
polls.
Case. Yeah, I mean, his job approval rating went up, not down. His supporters are even more fired up than they ever were. The Republican Party had completely closed ranks behind him. There were no really fractures left, except maybe Mitt Romney in Utah. And I think Republicans are baffled because they think the president should have just accepted the fact that he came out of this in great shape and moved on. But now we're talking about this instead. And that's the agony of the moment for Republicans, I think.
Interesting partnerships between John Bolton and John Kelly, who inside the administration fought hammer and tongs and now both sort of united in standing up for each other's reputation and criticizing the president. Axios reporting the president is asking for names of more people he should fire, and he's certainly receiving support from some Senate Republicans like Lindsey Graham, calling for more investigations of the president's critics. Folks, we'd like you all to stick around, Molly and Jerry, please, as well. We're talking about the week in news when we return the Democratic race to take on President Trump. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. In other news this week, China recalculated the toll from the coronavirus and came up with a much bigger number of those who are sick and those who have died. And the world braces both for an epidemic and the possible economic fallout. The venerable newspaper chain McClatchy files for bankruptcy, raising questions about the journalism and the journalists in the communities they serve. And the state of North Dakota settles with two Native American tribes and several individual voters over North Dakota's voter ID law. The state agreed to accept tribal IDs and to allow people who don't have a residential address to vote. My guest this hour, Gerald Seib. He's executive Washington editor for The Wall Street Journal. And Molly Ball. She's national political correspondent for Time magazine. So let's turn now to the Democrats, those who want to achieve the power and prestige of the White House. After the first primary vote on Tuesday in New Hampshire, leading Democratic candidates addressed rival crowds of supporters.
A campaign that some said shouldn't be here at all has shown that we are here to stay.
I'm Amy Klobuchar, and I will beat Donald Trump.
Our campaign is built for the long haul. And we are just getting started.
It ain't over, man. We're just getting started. Votes count too.
We are going to unite together and defeat the most dangerous president in the modern history of this country.
My guess is most listeners recognize those voices. Hard not to recognize that last one. But just in case, that was Pete Buttigieg, Amy Klobuchar, Elizabeth Warren, Joe Biden, and Bernie Sanders urging on supporters this week after the New Hampshire primaries. Molly Ball, what's your takeaway from what we saw transpire in New Hampshire? We at least figured out what happened by the end of the evening. Tell us at the end of the week how
it was so
looked.
Refreshing, wasn't it, to have an election where they actually counted the votes and told us who won, like, within 24 hours. And I was there at that second clip you played with Amy Klobuchar, who I think it's fair to say had the surprise of the night when she surged into third place, only a few thousand votes behind the first and second place finishers. And what that tells you is, I mean, when you come out of New Hampshire with three candidates around 20%, nobody reaching 30%, and a couple of candidates hot on their heels, this is a remarkably muddled and fluid race. This is, you know, it's sort of a running joke that pundits are always declaring Democrats to be in disarray, but they really are. And it's remarkable when you're on the ground talking to voters how much individual indecision they feel, right? This is not the case that it's sort of just a stalemate with a bunch of people really strongly committed to a bunch of different candidates. What's fracturing the field is that a lot of people are really undecided. And on the ground in New Hampshire, you would go to candidates' events, and really even on the eve of the election, they're saying, well, I still can't decide. I like multiple candidates. I'm trying to find the one I think has the best chance to win, but I don't know who that is. But the beneficiaries of that have been, well, the whatever the opposite of beneficiary, the victim of all of this has been Joe Biden. He's been the national front runner for basically in the 9 months that since he got into the race. And he has undergone a remarkable deflation based, I think, just on voters' assessment of his performance. And that has meant that there's no obvious person to succeed him in that lane of sort of mainstream moderate Democrats. And so you have Pete Buttigieg, Amy Klobuchar fighting over that lane, even as, you know, Elizabeth Warren seems to be struggling to stay in the sort of liberal lane.
So before we move on from Biden, we're going to take a few calls or a few questions that listeners posed us this week about this, because I think it's good for them to get some feedback from people who are enmeshed in this. So Molly Ball, Jim called from Omaha, Nebraska, and he asked us this about Biden's campaign funds.
I've gotten numerous texts from the Biden administration, which suggest to me that he's running out of cash to effectively compete in the upcoming primaries. Do you think this is true?
So what do you say, Molly?
Yes, it's definitely true that that Biden is in danger of going broke. He's always been a weak fundraiser. That was always one of his weaknesses as a candidate in his, you know, previous presidential runs and in the Senate. And that's continued into his presidential campaign. For someone who was the nominal front runner and the nominal sort of establishment candidate, it has been really striking how difficult it's been for him to raise funds. That suggests not only an inability on his part, but a lack of confidence from the sort of donor class of the Democratic Party, that they don't see him as – they've never seen him as invincible, and they were holding back waiting to see whether he could make the sale with voters. So, you know, Biden is clearly determined to sort of live off the land until we get to South Carolina at the end of this month.
I'm just imagining Joe Biden biovacking on this campaign.
but the fundraising issue is going to be now that being said, the desperation texts and emails are sort of standard fare for campaigns. I don't know that
so
that
there's,
necessarily
there's scare
texts
as well.
They're always trying to scare their supporters into giving more money. But in this case, I do think that there's a kernel of truth to the idea that the campaign is short on funds.
Jerry Seib, we're going to talk about some of the folks who are at the top ranks in New Hampshire and who are going out feeling ascendant at the moment. But we have had these questions from listeners. One of them is calling about one of the folks who did not fare as well. Cheryl has called from New Orleans, Louisiana, with a question about the status of Elizabeth Warren after Iowa and New Hampshire.
Don't you think it's prematurely – you are prematurely declaring the death of Elizabeth Warren's campaign, especially considering – everyone did the same to Amy Klobuchar before her great debate performance.
So Jerry Seib, question was not specifically aimed at you in terms of what you were doing, but at the same time, is the press, is the political establishment, are people, writing Elizabeth Warren out of the story when she placed better than Joe Biden, and yet people are all focusing on Biden and not on her?
Yeah. Well, look, first of all, I just want to declare I did not write off Amy Klobuchar. I predicted her rise three times before it actually happened. So on that one, I'm good. But look, there's something to what the caller's point. There is this tendency to reach sweeping conclusions after Iowa and New Hampshire. We see it every 4 years. We all engage in it every 4 years. And we all ought to just sit back and take a breath and let the voters have a bigger say in this process. Now, in terms of Elizabeth Warren, I think one of the things that is contributing to this perception is that the fall has been pretty dramatic for her, too. You know, if you go back, and I went back this week and looked, and in the first week of October, she was actually, for a brief time, ahead of Joe Biden, leading the entire pack in national polls. And so I think expectations were higher for her than the reality of Iowa and New Hampshire provided. So that's one problem. It's kind of dashed expectations. I think the other problem is a sense that Bernie is consolidating the liberal lane. It's not just that she did badly. It's just there had to be one or the other, and maybe it's going to be him. I will say that she has a very big organization in Nevada. She's going to go plant her flag there, and that, much as Joe Biden is planting his flag in South Carolina and saying, here's where I make my comeback, she is doing the same thing in Nevada, which votes in caucuses on February 22nd. So we'll see, and we probably ought to just wait and see, and I think that's a reasonable point.
You know, you mentioned Nevada. there was always there was a lot of buzz over who this major culinary union, which is a big player in Vegas and I guess more generally in Nevada, but particularly in Las Vegas, and getting out the vote and particularly the Latino vote there, where they were going to go. And they released this sort of response, I guess, to questionnaire they'd sent out to candidates that laid out their positions on issues and particularly on healthcare. And it did not go flatteringly for Bernie Sanders because some of the unions have won hard-fought healthcare policies and benefits that they don't want to subsume into some larger government program. And the spokeswoman for the union said they've received hundreds of attacks in the form of mentions, DMs, calls, and emails, including threats to personal safety. And the spokeswoman said that she and told reporters that she and another official there had been doxxed, that is, their personal addresses revealed publicly for essentially inviting further personal abuse. And the union, if I recall correctly, didn't endorse anyone, as it turned out. What is the takeaway from that? And my sense is that they're essentially implying this is Bernie Sanders' followers who are doing this, Jerry. But what is the takeaway from what's playing out there in Las Vegas right now?
Well, first of all, they're clearly implying that, if not saying that explicitly. And I think there are two takeaways from that. One is that one of the advantages that Bernie Sanders has is this incredibly passionate group of supporters, much like Donald Trump supporters. But the problem with that is they turn off some Democrats with their style and their tactics, and they raise the specter that they will stand in the way of the Democratic Party uniting at the end of this process. The second takeaway is that the substantive problem at the heart of this was always going to be there for Bernie Sanders and to some extent Elizabeth Warren, which is a Medicare for All plan says to union workers who have made sacrifices in terms of wages for years, if not decades, in order to get good health coverage, that they have to now give that health coverage up. And that does not go down well with some union audiences. And that's been discussed in Democratic debates as a hypothetical. In this statement from the Culinary Union, you saw the real-world version of that problem come to life, and that's not a small problem, I think.
And yet, you know, you would think the union's the natural allies. Molly Ball, does this offer an opportunity for a Pete Buttigieg or an Amy Klobuchar to make inroads?
Well, you know, it's interesting to me that despite their strongly worded objections to Sanders, the Culinary Union did not then try to put the thumb on the scale for a candidate that would be more to its liking on policy. You know, I was a reporter in Las Vegas for 6 years. The Culinary Union is very powerful, and as we see from this episode, impossible to intimidate. They're tough, they're fighters, and they know where they stand, but they're not helping, right? If the problem that the Democratic Party is having is that they can't decide which of the sort of non-Bernie candidates to elevate, by not making an endorsement, the union and you know, this is a union that always likes to pick a winner, likes to be on the winning side. But it means that they're not stepping out there and taking that risk of actually directing their members where they think they should give their votes, which means that potentially this race is going to continue to be muddled as the sort of, you know, moderate candidates snipe at each other while Bernie Sanders, you know, glides to another victory with a quarter of the vote. So that is the situation that has so many Democratic insiders panicked and concerned about how they're going to come out of this with a nominee.
So to that question, Molly Ball, Andrew called in from Dearborn, Michigan, and had a question about the divide that he's perceived between moderates and progressives in the Democratic Party.
My question is about this divide in the Democratic Party between moving to the left versus moving to the center. And I'm wondering what wisdom we have from history, past elections with an incumbent, and also what data there is out there that might justify the strategy of moving to the left versus moving to the center.
And Molly, you know, Jerry mentioned a minute or two ago the notion of a lane for moderates. And, you know, it sounded to me in some ways, you know, are Klobuchar and Buttigieg crowding each other out in certain ways, allowing Sanders to sweep sort of the table when it comes to people more on the left, as Warren has declined a little bit there. There's that question of lanes, and then this question Andrew raises about, is there an ability to knit people back together? Could somebody like Pete Buttigieg, who is criticized by Sanders followers as being something of a corporatist or a Republican in nice clothing, Is there a way for him to make an appeal if he were able to get people, or Klobuchar were able to get people to rally around her? Or could a guy like Bernie Sanders, somebody who's late to a Democratic field, actually reach out to people who are moderates, suburbanites, who might say, this isn't entirely for me, but I am trying to figure out ways to vote for the Democrat?
Yeah, all of the candidates are making an electability argument very overtly at this point because they know that that is what is preoccupying Democratic voters. And these lanes are somewhat fluid. I mean, I've met people at Bernie Sanders events who said that they were previously for Joe Biden. I've met people who are fans of Amy Klobuchar who say they supported, you know, Bernie Sanders 4 years ago. So voters are quirky and individual. But in the main, you definitely do see a clumping of different types of voters. And this is a perennial argument within both parties of whether to do the proverbial bold colors, right? Take a strong ideological stand that communicates your values to voters in a way that they may find compelling because it's sort of less wishy-washy, even if it's far out there, or to move to the center. And there is, to the caller's question, a quite robust political science literature on the question of, candidates who are perceived as more moderate, more centrist, more toward the middle, do tend to do better in competitive elections. In fact, one of the explanations for Donald Trump's win in many states in 2016 is that he was perceived as more moderate than Hillary Clinton by many voters. So voters are going to generally go with their heart and then rationalize it on the basis of electability, right? They're going to vote for who they like, but tell themselves that they're voting for the person that they think is going to win.
Although so fascinating to hear so many callers and so many voter interviews in which they seem to be playing political pundit themselves as they get there. We only have a couple minutes left, Jerry Seib. Just in the brief time we have left, I want to talk about Mike Bloomberg. I think it's time. The guy has dropped something like 9 figures on ads and campaigning so far, and he's going to spend a lot more and never miss it. Bloomberg, it seems to me, is able to get in the head of Donald Trump in an almost unique way because – he is a billionaire. He is a self-made man. He's done all the things that Trump has said he's been able to do. On the other hand, a lot of people are going through its rich archival history of things that Bloomberg has said and done that seemed almost genetically engineered to offend Democratic voters. How is Mike Bloomberg going to deal with that and address that as he seeks to get enough of a national base that he can't be ignored in the debates and in the vote?
Well, first of all, he gets in Donald Trump's head and under his skin like nobody else. And so, you know, that's in this context a campaign asset and attribute, I would say, for Michael Bloomberg. So that's probably the first thing to say. The second thing to say, I think, is that the scenario that we're talking about here is exactly the scenario Bloomberg had in mind when he got into this race in the first place. You have a slump, if not a collapse, by Joe Biden. You have a rise by Bernie Sanders that just petrifies many Democrats. And you have the president looking more viable as a reelection candidate. And that scares people to go to Michael Bloomberg. That's the scenario he envisioned. That's the one we're seeing. So there is that. Now, there is this problem, which you just pointed to, David, which is that he has said and done things that Democrats don't really like. But the proposition of the Michael Bloomberg is that will matter less in the long run than the ability to beat Donald Trump. And that's what I'm selling here.
I think we're going to be probably picking up both strands of that story. Michael Bloomberg, he has money to spend and the patience to do it. Jerry Seib of The Wall Street Journal, thanks so much for joining us.
Sure.
And thanks to you, Molly Ball of Time Magazine.
Thank you for having me.
You continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And don't forget to follow us on the Twitters and Facebook at On Point Radio. You've been listening to On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. Thanks so much.